This meeting is now being recorded.
Thanks very much. Welcome everybody, and thanks for calling in. I'm hoping that using the slides to sort of focus the issues will enable us to be efficient. Our agenda is pretty much the same as it was on the last call, with the exception of the one inconsistency that Malcolm Huddy identified we should address. So I've rearranged, because I think it's pretty straightforward, to take care of that one first. Brenda has asked everybody in chat who is listed by a telephone number if you could identify yourselves to her so that we know who to recognize when people have their hands up. So I think there are at least two people, it looks like LA, who might be in that circumstances. So with that, let's just go on to start the substantive discussion. Malcolm noted last time that there was an inconsistency between the final report of the CCWG and the draft updated supplementary procedures with respect to the time by which an IRP must be filed. The final report says a complaint must be filed within a certain number of days to be determined by the IRP subgroup. That's us. After the complainant becomes aware of the alleged violation and how it allegedly affects them. The draft supplementary procedures say that a claimant shall file a written statement of dispute no more than 45 days after a claimant becomes aware or reasonably should have been aware of the action or inaction giving rise to a dispute. Now, obviously, the reason that you would put in the should have been aware of is so that you don't have to deal with, you know, long after the fact disputes where someone says, I didn't know I was affected. And clearly also because these IRPs sometimes relate to disputed rights between one party who's a complainant and another party who's not, there is some reason to be concerned about people sitting on their rights or not exercising them. On the other hand, the language in the final report is that is limited to when a complainant becomes aware of the alleged violation and how it allegedly affects them. So because this is a change from the CCWG recommendation, I want to flag that and see what people, how people are inclined to handle this. Views? Nobody has views. Yeah, I'm sorry Malcolm's not here to explain his concern further. And I think I think that his concern is exactly what Mike Rodenbaugh is identifying in the chat, which is that you know, you can have a fight, a dispute, a disagreement, contention over when somebody reasonably should have been aware of the action or inaction. Greg?
Hi, this is Greg Chapman for the record, and I commented on this on the list, but just to go back to it, you know, the or reasonably should have been aware, you know, us lawyers call that constructive notice, because the underlying idea is that they did not, in fact, become aware, but they should have been. So you're talking about something that went by, but they're going to be stopped anyway, even though they didn't know that they were, their rights were ticking away. Was not what was expected in the final report. I think we should stick with, you know, becomes aware, which is actual notice, and not go into constructive notice, which, especially in this community, where things can be complicated, people can be volunteers, people can be, you know, going around the world for, you know, 14 days, to go to a 7-day meeting. That's just, I think it's unrealistic. So I would get rid of the red text.
Thank you, Greg. As I recall, there actually was some discussion and I think some expression of concern that, you know, not everybody who is affected is following ICANN, minute to minute. I think we might, one of the things that we might want to do, Bernie, can you tell me if it's possible to go back through the transcripts to see whether this issue was actually discussed?
Tall order, but we can try and do that, yes. It depends what your timing is. If it's tomorrow, I would say that's pretty close to impossible. If you give us until the next meeting, which is expected to be a week, we can certainly give it a try.
And there's a little bit of chat that's in here. So the requirement would be that somebody making filing an IRP would be required to set out when they became aware of the action or inaction, and presumably ICANN would have the ability to demonstrate that they should have become aware reasonably. And Jeff is pointing out that become aware itself is a little ambiguous. But I think that I agree with just the fact that ICANN has posted minutes wouldn't be necessarily awareness. That would be constructive awareness. Can I just get a sense from the group here as to what we want to do? Particularly keeping in mind that our job is at this point, to try to make sure that we don't do anything that's inconsistent with the final report. Greg, is your hand old or new?
It's kind of new. I guess I was just, you know, looking at Jeff Levy's statement in the chat. If the board posts minutes, but somebody doesn't read the minutes, they're clearly not aware of them. On the other hand, if the board posts minutes and we have a reasonable expectation that people read the minutes, then they reasonably would have been aware of those minutes even if they never read them. And their 45-day clock would start ticking from then, whether they knew it or not. So I think there's nothing ambiguous or confusing about actual awareness. You can get at the very fringes, you can get into issues of trying to, you know, prove actual awareness. I don't think the burden of proof is on the claimant to show when they were aware. I think they just need to make a a statement that they became aware of it on X date. And if we really want to get into, you know, nasty back and forth, somebody could say, no, you actually were aware of it on a prior date because you have an email from you, or you were, you know, we saw you sitting at this meeting and it was clearly stated. So your actual awareness date is even earlier than you think it is. But that's, you're still basing it on when something entered somebody's, you know, headspace. In fact, not on when it, you know, they reasonably could have had it happen. So I think there's, I don't think there's a lot of excitement here. Thanks.
Thank you. Samantha?
Hi, this is Sam Eisner from ICANN for the record. I think that there has to be some sort of bright line put on this, because and whether it's the 45 days or the reasonably should have been aware, whatever that ultimately winds up to be, we have to, when we look at accountability, we also have to get to the point that there can be some level of finality to decisions. It also doesn't benefit anyone to have decisions of the ICANN board or staff actions or anything be subject to challenge 2 years down the road because someone just decided to get interested in something and research an issue and decide that they were adversely affected by that issue and therefore they're going to come in and do it. There are people who, you know, if we look at this, you know, maybe someone want to come in 2 years down the road when they realize the new GTLD program had come into effect and start challenging it because it just hit the radar of their business purpose, right? And so there has to be some time frame that makes sense, and it can't just be up to when someone decided to pay attention to an issue, someone was told to pay attention to an issue, someone finally became aware that ICANN existed and started looking at it, because that doesn't increase ICANN's accountability to the rest of the community that needs to have some level of certainty. So as we walk down this path, I think we have to keep in mind that it's really important to have some bright line. I'm not saying what the bright line should be, but there has to be some bright line on this so that we can't always get into endless loops of decisions that were taken a while ago.
Okay, thank you. David?
Thank you, Becky. It's David McCauley for the record. And answering your question of where we are, I just want to say I think I'm somewhere between Sam and Greg. I think Sam brings a good point. There has to be some sense of timing involved that sort of imposes some discipline in the process in the interest of fairness to everybody. But I also think Greg has a good point about constructive notice. And I also think, and I may have this wrong, but I think when I read Malcolm's comments last week, that he actually was making the point that a change in status, if a person has a change in status, you know, 1, 2, 3 years down the road, that could actually give rise to a claim. And it struck me as odd, but, you know, I'm sort of open to considering it. And so one of the things I think we might keep in mind as we try and wrestle through this, and I'm parenthetically, I'll just like to say I'm sorry Holly's not on the call because it would be nice to have our legal drafters present. But one of the things we ought to
Can I just say, I just heard from Holly and Ed that they were not included in the invite. I think that somehow they're not on the list, so I've sent out the information, and hopefully they will join us, and we will endeavor to correct that.
Thank you. But what I was going to say is one thing that's in the back pocket that we can consider when we come up with some wording, and this is more to Malcolm's point, is to actually go to the full CCWG and say, in the final report, more extreme one, did we mean X, Y, or Z? We can ask a question for clarification. And so if we're struggling, we might be able to get some direction that way. Thank you.
Thank you, David. Greg?
I think good that David pointed us back to the final report, because I think that was, you know, fairly clear that actual awareness was what was intended in the final report. I appreciate the concern about finality, and there's obviously a tension here. I don't think 45 days is in any way appropriate in terms of a constructive notice deadline, or really in a sense it's kind of like a statute of limitations. although, you know, in some cases the statute of limitations don't even start to run until the date of actual awareness. But I don't want to get too deep in the weeds here, but I think the practical point is that a date of finality after which no claim could be brought regardless of the circumstances, you know, assuming that there's, that it wasn't completely hidden, you know, would be, would make sense, but it's got to be way longer than 45 days. I'm not entirely sure even that 2 years is too long. You know, kind of going back to Malcolm's point, there's, you know, there may be, you know, changes in circumstances and issues that, that come up that really, you know, are worthy of challenge. We don't know, but, you know, trying to find a middle ground, I would say that something, you know, far in excess of 45 days as a kind of finality date, would make sense, but not 45 days based on constructive awareness. And we did say 45 days after actual or X number of days, we, you know, to be determined by this group. And 45 days, you know, in terms of actual awareness seems reasonable to me. But again, the constructive notice, you know, maybe a year, just to throw a number out there for the sake of a number. Thanks.
Okay, so I am getting the sense that there is some support, there is support and sympathy for the notion that there has to be a date by which, you know, things are final and not challengeable and everybody can rely on it, that there should be, you know, a kind of statute of limitations in any event drop-dead date, but that the language in the final report was actual awareness. We will endeavor to go back and see whether that was a particular discussion point, and we should bring this issue back to the full CCWG to talk about what a drop-dead date should be there. That makes sense to everybody? Okay. David?
Thanks, Becky. It's David McCullough again. I think that makes sense to me what you said. If we do go back to the full CCWG, I think we should come back with a brief summary of the positions that we've been batting around. Excuse me. Malcolm's email from last week and some of the alternatives to sort of put it in context. I guess maybe we should. That was a, okay. Thank you.
Yeah, I think that's definitely right. I mean, just so you know, there's a full CCWG meeting. If I am remembering correctly, on the 30th or 31st of August, and so I would like to have that August 30th. So we would prepare a general report, and then on any issues that we want greater input on, we would provide a bit more detail there. I will endeavor to circulate that to the group beforehand to make sure that I've accurately captured the discussion points here. Okay, going on to the next items, I just want to talk, we spent a lot of time talking about what kind of burden of persuasion, whether it was clear and convincing, or whatever would be needed to convince the panel that an in-person hearing was necessary for a fair resolution of a claim, was necessary to further the purposes of the IRP, and the interests of a fair resolution outweighed the time and delay and costs associated with it. And I think I was at least quite persuaded by the conversation or the discussion in the chat that, you know, saying clearly demonstrates, which was sort of where most of the people on the call were going, was actually going to be confusing, and that we should either, you know, have a clear standard or no standard. So I went back and just wanted to just bring most of the people on this call are lawyers, so you guys will all be familiar with this. So I did this for purposes of the non-lawyers on the group, so I'll just run through it quickly. So generally, that the burden of persuasion means that it says what kind of standard of proof a party needs to make. So it would be the amount of evidence that a party needs to provide in order for the panel to reach a particular determination. And in U.S. civil cases, and this is maybe a standard elsewhere, I don't know, but in U.S. cases, there are three kinds of choices with escalating requirements, either a preponderance of the evidence, clear and convincing evidence, or substantial evidence. And substantial evidence usually applies in cases that are not particularly relevant. So just to compare the two, the preponderance of the evidence is what applies in most cases. And it would require the panel to permit an in-person hearing if the requesting party demonstrated that it is more likely than not that an in-person hearing is necessary for a just resolution of the issue, that it's necessary to further the purposes of the IRP, and the interests of justice outweigh the cost and delay in any particular case. So it's more likely than not that it meets the three criteria that we've established. The clear and convincing evidence standard is an elevated standard, but not the highest standard. And it would require the panel to permit an in-person hearing if the requesting party demonstrates that it's substantially more likely than not that it would meet the specified criteria necessary to result for a fair resolution, necessary to further the purposes of the IRP, and where the cost and delay outweighs the other interests. So I think Mike Rodenbaugh is agreeing that we shouldn't use clear if we're not going to use convincing. So I just want to go back to this standard. So I think our choices are either to say, just going back to this next language, that a person, the hearing would be, the panel determines that a person seeking the in-person hearing has demonstrated has demonstrated that an in-person hearing is necessary for a fair resolution of the claim, or has demonstrated with clear and convincing language. I will just say I don't really think that the clear and convincing standard is that high of a burden. However, I think there is concern that was articulated that it would pull in U.S. case law. So the question is, do we want to specify a standard, or do we want to leave it up to the panel to determine whether the demonstration has been made, keeping in mind that we have said that the person has to demonstrate in whatever fashion we specify that an in-person hearing is necessary for a fair resolution of the claim, that an in-person hearing is necessary to further the purposes of the IRP, and that considerations of fairness and furtherances of the purposes of the IRP outweigh the time and financial expense. In person, we are not talking about telephonic hearings, Mike. Supplemental rules provide for telephonic hearings. What we are trying to do is set a fairly high bar, but not a bar that defeats our purposes for a fair resolution. Greg?
It's Greg Chatton for the record. And I think, you know, we need to recognize that we already have a standard in here, which is the standard of extraordinary circumstances. So the circumstances themselves have to be extraordinary. So now we're not talking about whether or not we're talking about the level of proof that these extraordinary circumstances exist. This is the clear and convincing standard, or any standard we put in here, is not about whether these are extraordinary or not, but it's about whether the fact of these circumstances is being proven. That may seem like hair splitting, but I think that the burden, we don't necessarily need a heightened burden to prove extraordinary circumstances. The burden of that the circumstances be seen as extraordinary is sufficient. I don't know that we need to have any standard in there, because once we have a standard, then, you know, we're kind of either tying it to a U.S. standard or not, or we could make something up, you know, more likely than not, significantly more likely than not. But I think we need to distinguish between whether we're proving the likelihood of these circumstances or the extraordinariness. And I think it's the discretion of the panel to decide whether the circumstances being presented to them are extraordinary. The level of proof goes to whether these circumstances exist or not, not to whether they're extraordinary or not. Thanks.
Okay. David?
Thank you, Becky. It's David McCauley again. David McCauley. And I think I will say that I think Craig convinced me. What I think, where we came from on this was Sam had made a good point last call or the call before, you know, that we have to find a... Yes.
You cut out, so please start again.
I believe that Greg just convinced me, and I'm sorry if I cut out. And I think it's important to note that there is a presumption at work here, and that these three conditions are tools to get by the presumption in extraordinary circumstances. I think that Sam's request for some protection from this hearing, or if we put this in the context of cross-examination or whatever it might be, has to be unusual. This should not be the normal case, and we don't want panels becoming trial courts. You know, they are supposed to be arbitral panels. And I think, just listening to Greg, I think he made a good point. So I think that's all I want to say. I think he's convinced me that leave the presumption, leave the extraordinary circumstances and the three conditions. Thank you.
Okay, so I am hearing from those who are weighing in on this different things. One is that clear and convincing seems too high, and it could pull in U.S. case law, which might not make sense, that we have a high burden anyway because the definition of extraordinary circumstances is sufficiently high, and that we could leave it to the deference of the panelists. On the other hand, I think I will be I would be surprised if ICANN staff didn't make the point that that not having a standard creates the possibility of more motions practice and more debate about whether or not something has been appropriately demonstrated. And Robin saying, on the other hand, that maybe we should pick a standard because not having one means that we'll end up with conflicting standards. Don't know where I think, Greg?
Thanks. I've been trying to do some extremely rapid research on standards for proving extraordinary circumstances, and one place that seems to come up is in custody hearings and the like, and the language that I've found in a couple of different states for that is merely that it needs to be demonstrated to the satisfaction of the court that extraordinary circumstances exist. So, you know, that's getting away from any kind of evidentiary standard. You know, evidentiary standards are, you know, basically go to proving that something did or didn't happen. So I think we may actually, you know, kind of be in the wrong place when we're discussing evidentiary standards. And, you know, the idea is that we're supposed to, to the satisfaction of the panel might be a way to at least say that. I mean, it kind of, in essence, it goes without saying, because either they're going to say, yeah, we see it, these are extraordinary circumstances, let's all, you know, have a hearing in, X place, Geneva. I would say, no, we're not satisfied. These are not extraordinary circumstances, you know.
Okay, so just to be clear, I think the what I'm hearing as the weight of argument here is that we go with the language that is like the language that is up on the in the Adobe room, although this applies to the standard for cross-examination, which we are not going to talk about next, but so it would be basically an in-person hearing shall be allowed only in extraordinary circumstances where upon motion by a party, the IRP determines. We also had some other language. I think let me go back to the other one. But where upon motion by the panel, hold on one second. I just want to make sure I'm looking at the proper language. And I apologize for not. Okay, so it would say, where upon motion by a party, the IRP panel determines that the party seeking an in-person hearing has clearly demonstrated that an in-person hearing is necessary, et cetera. So, so I think the language that we're talking about is, do we go with the IRP panel determines that the party seeking an in-person hearing has demonstrated that it's necessary for a fair resolution, et cetera. And I'm just going to put this in the chat here. So, Amy or Sam or anybody want to, you know, I know ICANN is concerned that in-person hearings create a delay and significant expense and has concerns about whether we've set the bar high enough Do any of you guys want to speak to that? I don't want to move on without. Okay. Conditions 1 and 2, Mike, the difference is fair resolution and the purposes of the IRP are defined as, I'm just going to pull it up so I can look at it, to hear and resolve disputes for the reasons specified by the ICANN bylaws. So 1 goes to fair and just resolution, 2 goes to resolution, and 3 is the balancing test. I mean, we can add to the satisfaction of the panel, but I'm not sure that we need to do that if we just say the panel determines that the party has demonstrated. Okay, I'm not hearing a lot of resistance on this, so I think the desire is to take clearly out determines to the satisfaction of the panel. Anybody want to have a view on that? Robin typing. Robin, you can speak too. Okay. Nobody's strong feeling. Okay, so we'll let the lawyers talk about that. Okay, the next issue is cross-examination. The current rules do not permit cross-examination of witnesses at an in-person hearing. We've had sort of dueling draft language. The ICANN staff would like to leave it where it is with a prohibition on cross-examination. Other people have expressed the concern that, you know, if it meets the extraordinary circumstances test, then it ought to be permitted. Clearly, if we decided to go along with cross-examination of witnesses, it seems to me that the standard should be the same as the standard that we've just decided on. But open question, obviously, you know, what we are struggling with is a good accountability process, but also sort of an accessible and affordable and efficient accountability process. David?
Becky, hi. It's David McCauley again, for the record. I tend to believe that, and I've changed my views on this, but I believe cross-examination of a witness should be permissible in extraordinary circumstances, you know, so long as we can come up with the language that we're wrestling with on what is extraordinary, et cetera. With this language, the alternative for consideration that's on the screen, my only suggestion would be that on line 1 where it says cross-examination of live witnesses, I would rather say cross-examination of a live witness, singular. Just to sort of underscore the point that the issue should be decided on a witness-by-witness basis, not an IRP-by-IRP basis. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. And Mike is pointing out that the current language prohibits cross-examination even in electronic or telephonic hearings. Greg?
I tend to agree with what I'm seeing in the chat that, you know, not that we're talking about, you know, constitutional law question, but the right to confront the witnesses, and which is essentially the right to cross-examine, is a fundamental right in many types of cases, most cases. The idea that you're going to get to the point of a live case. I guess the question is whether we're saying that establishing the live hearing, is this a separate, first you've proven the need for an in-person hearing, and then you have to prove a second time that once you're all in a room, you have a chance to ask people questions. It seems to me that once you've gotten to the live hearing, cross-examined should be presumed. Not even presumed. It should just be a matter of fact. I don't even see why, where there's any burden separate from the burden of having a live hearing in the first place. Maybe one of the reasons you'd prove that a live hearing is necessary is because you need to, do cross, and not just rely on, interrogatories or witness statements or the like. But to have a second gating factor that, to prove that now that I've gotten you in a room, and then said that's a pretty extraordinary, I need to have kind of double extraordinariness to ask questions. I don't get it. Thanks.
Okay, so you would leave this, I guess we have two different approaches by people who believe that cross-examination should be permitted. One is that, in fact, you should, the party making the request should have to demonstrate that in-person hearing meets the criteria, and then cross-examination is necessary. Sam is making the point. There could be situations where the argument is complex, so presumably an in-person hearing is necessary, but the credibility of witnesses is not at issue, which would support a live hearing without the need for witnesses. Live hearing means in-person, Aubrey. The rules do provide for telephonic hearings, not subject to the extraordinary standard. So there can always be the telephonic hearings. You guys still there? So I guess my question is, Mike Rodenbaugh raised the question and is saying in chat that that even for telephonic hearings, the current rules would say that cross-examination must still be necessary for the purposes. And Amy and Sam, can you tell me whether that's correct? I'm having trouble finding it. Greg?
Thanks for Mike for that point. I'm taking the word on it because I haven't found the look at the current standards. But of course, the new IRP is quite a different animal from the old IRP. And I think that the necessary standard is probably too high for that. On the phone, the whole idea that you can't actually talk to people across the table is just beggars my imagination. So the standard I would propose, which I proposed in chat, would be that cross is allowed unless it would be vexatious or frivolous, totally without merit or something along those lines. Because I don't want people just noticing 30 live crosses just to make people suffer. And that does happen. I was just talking about somebody who had that happen in a case. Useless cross. But if it's above that level, then as long as it's useful, it seemed to me that it should be allowed. It's really just pretty much a standard part of most types of adversarial hearings. Of course, we're all one big happy family. None of them adversarial.
Okay. Please mute your telephones if you're not speaking. Mike?
Hey, Becky, thanks. So right now the draft says that even a phone or video hearing has to be deemed necessary, which I think is wrong. I think those should be as a matter of course, as pretty much they have been in almost every IRP proceeding to date. So I'd like to discuss that. And then the issue we're discussing right now is whether there should be cross-examination. And it seems to me that that standard, the standard whether or not to have cross, should not matter what kind of hearing it is. Regardless whether it's video, phone, or in-person hearing, cross-examination should be allowed because that's just a fundamental part of a hearing. That's why you have a hearing. If there are witnesses, they must be cross-examined.
Thank you, Mike. So I think could somebody mute their phone because I'm getting a big echo here. Okay, so the current standard is that all hearings are, well, let's take this in two orders. The IRP panel should conduct its proceedings by electronic means to the extent feasible. Where necessary, the IRP panel may conduct live telephonic or video conferences. So Mike is correct that there is a presumption that we proceed by electronic means. If the IRP panel decides it's necessary for whatever reasons, because remember there's no extraordinary standard set out here, they can conduct live telephonic or video conferences. Then we have proposed the extraordinary circumstances standard for an in-person hearing. And then the further question is the language which limits all hearings to argument only, whether it's telephonic or in person a witness hearings. That's what we're discussing now. I hear you, Mike, you want to put the sort of necessary in general for an electronic hearing back on the table, but let's try to resolve this one first. Greg?
Good answer.
Old hand? Okay, so the question, I'm definitely hearing that if at least with in-person hearings, to the extent that a panel determines that the extraordinary circumstances warranting an in-person hearing are present, some people are saying that should be enough. Other people. And cross-examination of witness should be permitted. Other people are saying, no, in addition, the panel should make a specific determination that cross-examination of witnesses or the putting on of witnesses for sort of purposes other than making the argument itself should be required. I need some help here because I think people are, it's hard for me to follow the chat and the discussion. Both of those things. David?
Thanks, Becky. It's David McCall again. I've been trying to listen and follow the chat too. It is very hard. I simply would say I think our purpose here is not to build a trial. I don't think we're trying to build trial process here. What may be a good idea is to, in the extraordinary case that a hearing is needed, have the witness statements passed back and forth, and then If someone wants to cross-examine, they can go to the panel and say, we would like to cross-examine 3 out of the following 10 witnesses that have been listed. And the other party can challenge it, and the panel can make a decision. But it just seems to me it shouldn't be willy-nilly that every witness in the case gets to be cross-examination. Thank you.
Thank you, David. Okay, so I stand by my characterization of people being on somewhat different perspectives on this. Okay. What I think I'm going to propose is that we take this back and try to get some concrete alternative language in front of people to look at and debate in a concrete way to do this. Mike, I just want to get to the next issue on the agenda, but I am not ignoring the fact that you object to the language about a determination of necessity for telephonic hearings. The next issue is scope. We're going to break this discussion into two sections. The first one is that right now, IRPs that have been commenced right now, that exist right now, would be subject, would continue under the existing supplementary rules. But we know that the rules that we are updating, the updated supplementary rules, may well change. And in that circumstance, we're saying that if the updated supplementary procedures are established, the amendments would not apply to pending IRPs unless a party successfully demonstrates that application of the former supplementary procedures would be unjust and impractical to the requesting party, and application of the amendment would not materially disadvantage any party's substantive right. And the request to apply amended, updated supplementary procedures will be resolved by the IRP panel in the exercise of its discretion. Now, because the standard of review for these updated supplementary rules is actually specified in the bylaws, that standard of review is not going to change it unless there is a very material, you know, change to the bylaws and like. So in this case, what we're talking about is sort of allowing people to take advantage of differences in procedural rules. For example, if we you know, decided to tweak the page length or something like that. And the sense that I got from the group last week is the scope page. I don't know which scope page do you want, David. The sense that I got last week was that people were tending to the notion that if somebody demonstrated that it would be unjust and impractical not to apply any modifications and it wouldn't materially disadvantage the other party's rights, they should be permitted to do it. I think ICANN still remains concerned that this could complicate the process without real benefits and proposes deletion. I have to say, since we are not talking about the substantive standard of review, really, in this one, I could go either way and, you know, and think, you know, you might, that I can, you know, the concern about complications without real benefit might be meaningful, but I also don't have a problem with the language that's up there. So, David, this this one actually goes to the update. This goes back to the substantive standard. So it's not really the same thing that we're talking about. Okay, we are getting very close to the top of the hour. Okay, so I think people are feeling like, with respect to the non-material rules, there's not a lot of benefit. Aubrey?
Thanks. Thanks, Aubrey speaking. On this one, on the scope, I don't quite understand why we assume that there could not be substantive change. You talk about the tweaking of the rules after these new rules are established, but that's not something that we can really know at this point. So I don't quite understand the presumption that this would only apply to procedural and not to substantive changes that may be made after the new rules go into effect. Or maybe I'm misunderstanding. Thanks.
So, Aubrey, just let me explain a little bit. What I'm saying is that the standard of review in here is, you know, the de novo examination of the dispute as to whether it met the, you know, so whether it was a violation of bylaws, et cetera. That is determined in the bylaws right now. That language exists in the bylaws, and we cannot change the standard of review from the bylaws without changing the bylaws themselves. So that's why I'm saying it really goes to the procedural, the page limits, time for filing, but probably it could go to the questions of a hearing or not a hearing. But all of those things are, to me at least, things that are more procedural.
If I can ask further, I know I didn't wait to be called on, then we're almost out of time, but for example, various of the processes that are going on now may indeed change things in the bylaws, in the WS2 and such. So, and then the rules that come out, you know, any updates that came out on this UPS after that, could well have a substantive bearing. So I guess I'm confused, but
yeah. That
happens often.
Yeah. Let me try and explain this one more slightly differently. The standard of review here, just in the case of bylaws, is a de novo examination of whether or not the board violated the bylaws, or the ICANN violated the bylaws. If the bylaws change, then the question of whether the ICANN violated the bylaws, would be a question of what the bylaws were at any point in time. And so the panel would have to determine what the bylaws were and whether ICANN violated them. So I guess that does mean that existing that if somebody files an IRP on a bunch of grounds and then suddenly the bylaws provision on human rights changed, the standard that the panel would need to look at would be the bylaws that existed, at the time of the, of the filing. Although, I think, people could bring stuff in. We're now at the top of the hour, if I can, this is too important a discussion to rush. So we do have time slotted for next week. What I hope we can do is limit our review to sort of the things that are outstanding and then really dig into this issue. And I think fundamentally, what we're trying to do is be equitable, but not create a situation where people get to completely relitigate issues because there is a modification in the procedures. And I think that is a really, that's a really substantive issue in terms of sort of, if we know that there are going to be tweaks to these, to the rules, because that's, one of our jobs is, our next job is going to be to sort of go through the rules in a more comprehensive format. What amount of sort of opportunity for relitigating on the basis of of procedural issues do you want to permit? I think that's what we are going to need to sink our teeth into on the next call. I will go back and send around some proposed alternatives on the language that we talked about earlier. Bernie, I think that we did pick a time for next week. If we didn't, we should do that right away. Okay. With that, since we are at time, I think let's call it a day. Thanks, everybody. Same place, same time next week. Bye-bye.
Bye all.